1 Corinthians 13, one of the most familiar and beloved passages in the New Testament. In my experience, it's probably the scripture reading most requested by brides and grooms. I know it was read at our wedding, although I had to ask my wife because I couldn't remember for sure. By the way, my wife, Mary Fancher, the first Mary Fancher, was not the first Mary Fancher. When I got to the College of Worcester, several professors and people had asked me, "Are you related to Mary Fancher?" And I said, "No." And they said, "Oh, well, she graduated from here 2 years ago." So there was a Mary Fancher before the Mary Fancher. Before Mary Fancher. Yeah, as part of a marriage ceremony, 1 Corinthians 13, I mean, it's almost a no-brainer, right? Because of its lofty yet practical description of the characteristics of love, a love that's mature and committed. But that brief 13-verse chapter was not written with flowers and kisses and frilly wedding dresses in mind. Paul did not write it in praise of the romantic love that sparks couples' dreams and moves them to make lifelong vows. Now, there's certainly not anything wrong with reading it that way. I mean, the passage does capture the joy and the warmth and the possibility that surrounds a couple as they launch themselves into a life of married companionship. But it might surprise you to learn that Paul wrote these lovely words as a form of discipline for poor behavior. This section of Paul's first letter to the Corinthians was written with the express intent of trying to redirect the Corinthian Christians away from some selfish, inconsiderate behavior. You see, the Christian church in Corinth was, shall we say, misbehaving. Earlier in the letter, Paul had commented to the Corinthians about behaviors within that faith community, behaviors that were contrary to the example of Jesus, a manner of living, mind you, which supposedly they wanted to emulate. In chapter 3, Paul commented on their tendency to be jealous and quarrelsome. Elsewhere in the letter, he pointed out their boastfulness, their arrogance, their tendency to pursue personal self-interest over the common good. He actually brought up instances of particularly shameful behaviors, such as making fun of the poorer members in their church, or using the Lord's Supper as a time of gluttony rather than an occasion to build true fellowship and spiritual unity. So in response to the reports that he'd heard about their un-Christ-like behavior, Paul wrote this beautiful, beloved, inspiring passage about what love should look like in a community of faith, showing great control over his own disappointment and anger. Paul described what their shared life as a church would be when they embraced love as their modus operandi, as their way of being. Who would have imagined that such unbecoming attitudes and actions were what was behind the familiar, beloved words of 1 Corinthians 13? Happily, I don't think that those unfortunate behaviors are at all characteristic of this congregation or of the vast majority of churches seeking to embody and demonstrate the way of Jesus to the world around us. And yet, Paul's message can still encourage us and guide us, even though it was written to a different community and written for a different purpose. In the first section, he reminded us that the spiritual actions we might engage in are meaningless if not motivated by selfless, other-focused love. As examples, Paul notes two activities that were favored by the Corinthians: spirit-inspired eloquence and garnering public favor by acts of generosity. But to show that he wasn't just picking on them, in this section, Paul also mentioned a spiritual gift that was a favorite of his: speaking prophetically from special knowledge. And Paul wrote that without being inspired and motivated by sincere, committed, divinely inspired love, without being motivated by love, eloquence is as meaningless as the bells and whistles that were common to the worship rituals of some of the pagan cults in that area. Without love as the motivation, having special insight offers no advantage. If approval or fame is the motivation rather than sincere love, even acts of generosity or sacrifice are shallow, ingenuine. The second section of this chapter describes the qualities of love. Paul helped to clarify what love is by pointing out what it isn't. Love isn't jealousy or conceit or pride, rudeness, selfishness, prickliness, score-keeping, or a quality that many of us may have been introduced to by the Broadway musical called Avenue Q, where they share that German term Schadenfreude, which means delight at someone else's misfortune. In Paul's view, much of the behavior of the Corinthians tended to be the antithesis of divinely inspired love. And then the third section of the letter, it seems that it digresses from the praise of love. Paul writes about childhood versus adulthood, about seeing a dim image in a mirror. But Paul's actually reinforcing his argument. He explained that just as adulthood should signal an end to childlike behaviors, spiritual maturity should put to rest the selfishness, the disrespect, the jealousy, other qualities that are characteristic of immaturity. And Paul went on to say that at best, our vision, our understanding of God's loving kindness is incomplete. We only incompletely perceive God's nature. It's as if we were looking into a foggy mirror. The Corinthians' ears would have perked up at that, because one of Corinth's noted industries was the manufacturing of mirrors, especially mirrors made of highly polished bronze. And so Paul's point was that while our vision, our knowledge of God's love in this life is imperfect, the time will come when God will speak to us face to face. We will know God as clearly as God already knows us. In Paul's love chapter, his argument, it comes down to this: the love we share with one another is the foretaste of our ultimate union with God, graciously given to us now and shared with our brothers and sisters. The divine love that waits us in the resurrection life is given to us to practice with, so to speak, to practice with in this life. God invites us to practice divine love with one another. After all, one cannot merely decide in a day's time to start doing these things. They are learned patterns of behavior that must be cultivated over time in the context of a community that models and supports such behavior. We must learn patience. We must be taught how to not keep score of wrongs done against us. The church should be a school for the cultivation of these habits, these practices. Because you see, we're not changed by a miracle. We are conditioned. We're trained. We're taught. And then we practice how to exhibit the qualities of love in our relationships with family and friends, with our social circles, in our church, in our communities, and in the world community. God has given us love not only to guide many of us into marriage and family life, but to guide us in fashioning a community of mutuality. We might think of the church as Christ's training ground. In the church we are taught. In the church we practice what it is we want to preach with our lives. Being part of Christ's church guides us in learning to rise above mere self-interest. It teaches us to value and embody patience, kindness, truthfulness, endurance, faithfulness, hope, or to put it in a word, to embody love.